So if I asked you to describe, you know, the ancient Jewish Messiah, you'd probably picture a peaceful teacher, right?
Right, or maybe like a righteous king riding into his city.
Yeah, exactly. But you probably wouldn't picture a fire-breathing, reincarnated space traveler who destroys entire armies just with his voice.
I mean, no, that's definitely not the Sunday school version.
No. But the crazy thing is, in first century Judea, that was exactly what some people were desperately waiting for.
And, you know, that extreme variation tells us so much. We tend to view historical theology as this really neat, orderly progression.
Like a straight line.
Yeah, like a straight line. But the reality on the ground was it was a chaotic collision of wildly different hopes.
Well, welcome to today's deep dive. Our mission today is to unpack this historical pressure cooker, really, that
Okay.
forged the whole concept of the Messiah just before the time of Jesus. We're drawing from this fascinating lecture by Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino. It's all about Jewish messianism. And I mean, what becomes immediately clear when you look at Tomasino's research is that there wasn't just one single universally agreed upon job description for a savior.
Not at all. It was completely a conceptual melting pot.
Yeah.
And to understand what kind of rescue the people of Judea were waiting for, we really first have to understand the mechanisms of their suffering.
The why before the what?
Exactly. You don't get these intense apocalyptic theological shifts in a vacuum. You get them when a society is just pushed to the absolute breaking point.
And looking at the historical record, the physical and psychological pull of the Roman occupation seems, frankly, almost unbearable. So, like, paint a picture of daily life in Jerusalem during this era.
Yeah, the misery index is staggering.
Yeah.
Judea is completely reeling from the Roman conquest. And one of the very first administrative moves the Romans made was to return several conquered Greek cities back to their original Greek residents.
Wow. Okay. So, what happened to the Jewish people living there?
Well, they were kicked out. This instantly displaced a massive population of Jewish families who had settled in those cities.
So Jerusalem didn't just have a political problem with Rome. It was an infrastructure collapse due to a massive refugee crisis.
Precisely. You have thousands of displaced families fleeing into Jerusalem, and it's a city that simply cannot support them.
Right.
So you have widespread homelessness, people begging in the streets, just a severe strain on local resources. And then you layer on top of this humanitarian crisis the crushing weight of Roman taxation.
Because the occupying legions have to be fed.
Fed and funded.
Right.
And that burden falls entirely on the local populace.
You know, I actually found Tomasino's detail about those taxes super fascinating because it totally upends our sort of cartoonish image of biblical tax collectors.
Excellent.
Like, we tend to imagine figures like Matthew in the New Testament as these greedy, independent swindlers just stealing extra money off the top for themselves.
Right, the mustache twirling villain.
Exactly. But Emperor Augustus actually implemented sweeping reforms to the tax system, didn't he?
He did, yeah. Augustus recognized that the old system of tax farming.
Where private collectors basically just bid for the right to extort a region.
Exactly. That system was causing way too much instability in the empire. People were revolting. So he passed strict laws to severely limit graft and streamline the whole process.
Oh, wow.
So by the time we get to the first century, a local tax collector wasn't necessarily a cartoon villain lining his own pockets. He was a highly efficient bureaucratic cog in the Roman machine.
Which honestly means the intense hatred toward tax collectors wasn't just about financial corruption. It was totally ideological.
100%. They were hated because they were the local face of an inescapable occupation.
Right. Like, if your rent has tripled to pay for foreign barracks and displaced refugees are literally sleeping in your alleys, you don't care if the tax collector is following the law. The law itself is the enemy.
Exactly. And beyond the economic ruin, there is a profound psychological humiliation at play here, too.
Because of their history.
Yes. Just a few generations prior, the Jewish people had actually won back their independence.
The Hasmoneans, right?
Right. After centuries of being conquered by the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Greeks, they established their own sovereign state under this local Jewish royal family called the Hasmoneans. So for a brief, shining moment, they were actually free.
And then the Roman war machine just rolls right in, and they are violently subjugated all over again.
It's devastating.
I mean, you wouldn't just want a new politician to vote for at that point. You would want a superhero. You'd want divine intervention.
And that desperate need for intervention is what drove people back to their ancient texts. You know, in an era before mass communication, you have to imagine these communities gathering in synagogues.
Or like those sects hiding out in the desert.
Yeah, the Essenes isolated themselves in the desert, obsessively reading and rereading prophetic scrolls, looking for just any sign that this nightmare was going to end.
And people in a crisis, they are incredibly good at finding patterns.
They really are.
So they scour the book of Daniel, and they find what seems to be a terrifyingly perfect prophetic coincidence regarding Rome.
Yeah, so Daniel contains this really vivid vision of four successive beasts representing four world empires.
Right.
And the text describes the fourth and final beast as this terrifying, mighty creature with iron teeth, crushing everything under its feet.
I mean, if you are living in first century Judea, watching Roman legions literally march through your streets in iron armor, that description isn't a metaphor. It's the evening news.
It was undeniably Rome to them. And Tomasino highlights this brilliant linguistic connection found in one of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Oh, the pun.
Yeah. The scholars in that community noticed that the Hebrew word used in Daniel for crush is Ramas.
Ramas. I mean, it sounds phonetically identical to Rome.
Right. And in a highly oral culture, a phonetic coincidence like that is a theological earthquake.
Like proof positive.
Exactly.
Exactly.
For the people reading these texts, that pun was proof. They believed the end of the age wasn't some distant future event. It was happening right then. And according to Daniel's prophecy, this fourth beast was destined to be destroyed to make way for a divine rescue.
Okay, but this is where I really need to push back, or at least clarify a massive point of confusion for, I think, a lot of us.
Sure.
We are talking about these communities flipping through the Old Testament, desperate to find the Messiah. But Tomasino explicitly points out that the phrase, the Messiah, does not even exist in the Old Testament as an end times title. Like, how is that even possible?
I know, it's wild. It really requires a major shift in how we understand ancient language. The English word Messiah comes from the Hebrew Mashiach, which literally just means anointed, or even more practically, smeared.
Smeared, that's so unglamorous.
Very much so. It referred to the physical everyday ritual of smearing special oil on someone's head to designate them for a specific job or office.
So it wasn't a proper noun, it wasn't like a name.
Not at all. In the Old Testament, a priest was a Mashiach, a prophet was an anointed one, the reigning king was the ultimate anointed one.
But always with a lowercase m.
Exactly. It was a job description, not an apocalyptic superhero title.
Okay, so if the Old Testament didn't have this built-in apocalyptic Messiah concept, where did this intense obsession with a singular coming savior actually originate?
Well, it was born out of what felt like a broken promise.
A broken promise.
Yeah, in the historical books, specifically 2 Samuel chapter 7, God makes a very clear, unconditional promise to King David. He says David will have a perpetual, unending dynasty. A descendant of David is supposed to sit on the throne forever.
Basically a guarantee of permanent national stability.
Right. And for a few hundred years, down in the southern kingdom of Judah, it held true. Every king was from the line of David.
Until
the Babylonian Empire invades. They completely destroy Jerusalem. The throne is emptied. The king is blinded and taken into exile. And that royal line is effectively shattered.
Oh, man. You can imagine the existential panic. The people are clinging to these texts asking, wait, did God break his promise? How can the throne be empty if the dynasty is supposed to be forever?
And that crisis of faith is the exact pivot point for messianism.
How so?
Well, if the David king isn't on the throne right now, the logic goes, it must mean God is preparing to raise up a new David in the future to restore the nation.
Ah.
So the prophets start using language about a righteous branch that will sprout from David's family tree to gather the exiles and bring endless peace.
But history rarely goes according to the blueprint, right? Because eventually the exiles return and they do get a Jewish kingdom back under that Hasmonean dynasty we mentioned earlier. But it's the wrong family.
Exactly. The Hasmoneans are not from the tribe of Judah and they certainly aren't from the line of David. They are a priestly family who essentially took the throne by force.
Right.
And as they become increasingly corrupt and secular over the decades, the local population starts to view them as illegitimate usurpers.
Which leads to this incredible boiling over of frustration. Tomasino examines a text called the Psalms of Solomon, written around 50 BC, and the language is just, it's visceral.
It's intense.
The writers are actively praying for God to raise up a true son of David, but they don't want, like, a diplomat. They want a warlord who will violently shatter unrighteous rulers and purge Jerusalem of Gentiles.
Yeah, and that intense hatred in the Songs of Solomon is directly linked to a specific historical trauma.
What happened?
Well, just over a decade earlier, the Roman general Pompey had besieged Jerusalem. And when the city fell, Pompey marched right into the temple, and he stepped inside the Holy of Holies.
Oh, wow. The innermost sanctuary.
Exactly. The most sacred sanctuary where God's presence was believed to dwell. It was a room only the high priest could enter, and only once a year.
So the psychological violation of a pagan general just strolling into the most sacred space on earth, that would be devastating.
Completely devastating. It makes perfect sense why they were begging for a military genius to crush the Romans like clay pots.
And this expectation of a violent warrior king became so pervasive that it actively shaped their political reality, didn't it?
It did. It spawned a series of actual warlords who claimed the title of the promised deliverer.
Like actual guys stepping up saying, I'm the one.
Yes. Culminating in 135 AD with a man named Simeon Bar Kokhba.
Mm-hmm.
He led a massive, bloody, and ultimately doomed rebellion against Rome. And he was hailed by many prominent rabbis as the literal Messiah.
That's incredible. But, you know, a warrior king only solves a political problem, right? Like, he gets rid of the Roman army.
Right.
But as we see in the historical record, some factions in Judea believed the Roman occupation was just a symptom of a much deeper disease. They believed the real rot was spiritual.
Exactly.
I mean, a guy with a sword can't forgive sins or purify a defiled temple.
And this brings us to the fascinating divergence in messianic expectations. Because if you believe the core problem is political, you want a king. But if you believe the core problem is a broken covenant with God, human military intervention isn't going to cut it.
You need a completely different kind of figure.
Right.
It kind of reminds me of a composite sketch drawn by 50 different terrified witnesses. Everyone is adding a different feature. You know, a sword, a priestly robe, fire-breathing lungs, based on what they are most personally afraid of.
That is a great way to put it.
So let's look at the priestly Messiah first. Because in texts like the Testament of Levi, the ultimate deliverer isn't from the royal tribe of Judah at all. He is from the priestly tribe of Levi.
Yeah, because if the root problem is sin, the primary solution has to be atonement. And this priestly focus is heavily inspired by a structurally bizarre passage in the book of Zechariah, chapter 6.
Okay, what happens there?
Well, the prophet is instructed to make an ornate crown. But instead of putting it on the descendant of David, he is told to put the crown on the head of Joshua, the high priest.
Wait, priests wear specialized headdresses, but they don't wear royal crowns.
Exactly. The lines are blurring. The text implies that this priest is going to build the temple and somehow rule.
And this blurring of duties leads some groups to want both, right? Like the Essene community who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yes. They envision not one, but two messiahs working simultaneously.
Comesino describes this incredible imagery from the Dead Sea Scrolls of an eschatological dinner party, like a banquet at the end of the world.
Right.
The king and the priest are both sitting at the table, but the priest actually has preeminence. He gets the most honor.
And that seating arrangement perfectly illustrates their hierarchy of values. In their minds, the king's job is just the dirty work defeating enemies, securing borders.
The bouncer.
Right, the bouncer. But the priest's job is the eternal work teaching righteousness and procuring atonement. So to that specific community, the spiritual leader fundamentally outranks the military leader.
But even a perfect high priest is still just a human. And for many people, the sheer scale of the Roman Empire made human intervention seem kind of laughable. They needed something cosmic.
So they looked upward, which leads to angelic messianism.
Angelic messianism.
Yeah. In texts found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, like 11Q Melchizedek, the deliverer is envisioned not as a human king or priest, but as the archangel Michael becoming incarnate to personally lead the final battle.
The ultimate cosmic warrior. And it's fascinating that this idea didn't completely die out in antiquity. Tomasino notes that even today, there is a prominent modern Christian group that maintains the theological belief that Jesus was actually the incarnation of the archangel Michael.
These ideas have remarkable staying power. And the ancient writers were pulling this from Daniel chapter 12, which states that Michael, the great prince, will arise during a time of unparalleled distress to deliver the people.
And when the distress on the ground feels unparalleled,
you expect the great prince to show up.
Right. But Michael wasn't the only supernatural candidate, which brings us to arguably the most complex title in this entire landscape, the Son of Man.
Oh, this one is fascinating. Going back to Daniel chapter 7, Daniel sees those terrifying beast empires rising from the sea. But then the vision shifts to the heavens, and he sees one like a son of man coming on the clouds.
And that phrase basically just meant a human, right?
Essentially, yes. It meant a human being. He looked human. In stark contrast to the monstrous beast kingdoms. and God gives this human figure an everlasting, indestructible kingdom.
But the interpretation of who this Son of Man was evolved drastically over the next few centuries.
Drastically.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we get to later texts like 4 Ezra, which was written after the Romans destroyed the Second Temple in 70 AD, the Son of Man is no longer just a symbolic representation of faithful humans.
He's something else entirely.
He is a literal, terrifyingly powerful, supernatural entity. He doesn't need to gather an army. He flies on the clouds, destroys his enemies by breathing literal fire upon them, and turns back entire legions with his voice alone.
I mean, it sounds like a full-on fantasy epic. And the wildest detail is found in a text called First Enoch, where they identify exactly who this cosmic, fire-breathing Son of Man actually is.
Yeah.
It's the biblical figure Enoch himself.
Right. Enoch is such a fascinating character in Genesis because the text says he walked with God and was no more. He seemingly bypassed death.
Just skipped it.
Exactly. An ancient Jewish tradition expanded his story massively. Think about it. In a world where everyone around you is dying brutally at the hands of an empire, a human who conquered death, ascended to heaven, and learned cosmic secrets becomes the perfect candidate to return as a divine judge and savior.
That makes total sense. So we have warlords, high priests, incarnated archangels, and a reincarnated fire-breathing Enoch. The theological landscape is incredibly crowded.
Very crowded.
With all these fiercely competing expectations, how does any single figure claim authority? I guess you adopt the most powerful title in the room. But as Thomasina's lecture points out, one specific title came with massive political baggage, the Son of God.
Yes. The historical context around that specific phrase is so crucial. For a very long time, many modern scholars just assumed that Son of God was always a standard, universally recognized Jewish title for the Messiah.
Primarily because it's the central title used for Jesus in the New Testament.
Exactly. But that assumption completely ignored the political reality of the ancient Near East.
Oh, so.
Well, the Old Testament does occasionally refer to the king metaphorically as God's son, like in Psalm 2. But it wasn't heavily used as a formal apocalyptic title in pre-Christian Jewish texts. However, in the broader Roman world, Son of God was an incredibly common, legally binding title for a very different kind of king.
The Roman Emperor.
Precisely.
Mm-hmm.
Emperor Augustus demanded to be recognized officially as the Son of God, as the adopted son of the deified Julius Caesar. Subsequent emperors followed suit. It was the ultimate tool of imperial propaganda.
And this leads to one of the most revealing scholarly mix-ups Thomasina highlights.
Oh, this is a great story.
Right. Decades ago, scholars translating the Dead Sea Scrolls found a fragmented text that seemed to refer to a coming figure as the Son of God. They celebrated, thinking they had finally found the exact Jewish root for the Christian messianic title.
But further analysis showed they were completely misreading the context of the scroll.
They got it backwards.
Completely backwards. The figure being called the Son of God in that specific text wasn't the promised hero. He was the villain. He was an arrogant, blasphemous persecutor of God's people.
So the Jewish writers were essentially mocking Roman propaganda.
Exactly. They were saying, this emperor demands to be called the Son of God, but he's really just the terrifying beast from Daniel's vision.
Wow. Which brings us to a really vital understanding of early Christianity. When early Christians started calling Jesus the Son of God, it wasn't just a quiet theological statement made in a vacuum.
No, it was a deeply subversive political declaration.
Yeah.
They were directly undercutting the absolute authority of Rome. They were sending a message, you claim your emperor is the Son of God who brings peace through violence. Well, we already have our Son of God, and his kingdom operates on entirely different principles.
That completely reframes how you read the New Testament. So looking at the historical figure of Jesus, how does he navigate this absolute minefield of competing expectations we've been talking about?
Well, the early Christian movement managed to weave together almost all of these disparate threads into a single narrative.
Okay, let's break that down.
Sure. Jesus is presented genealogically as the descendant of David, so that fulfills the royal expectation.
Right.
But then the book of Hebrews presents him as the ultimate high priest who offers himself as the atoning sacrifice, which fulfills the priestly expectation from texts like the Testament of Levi.
And he frequently adopts that heavily loaded title from Daniel, the Son of Man.
He does. And he uses it brilliantly to hold tension. Throughout his ministry, he uses Son of Man to emphasize his poverty and human vulnerability.
Saying things like, the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head.
Right. But at his trial before the high priest, when pushed to the absolute limit, he drops the humility and quotes Daniel 7 directly. He declares they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. He merges extreme human suffering with absolute cosmic authority.
Wow. So he effectively checks the boxes across the entire messianic multiverse. The royal bloodline, the priestly atonement, the cosmic authority. So why was he largely rejected by the Judean establishment of his time?
It's a great question.
Because the historical record is clear that it wasn't because he claimed to be the Messiah or claimed supernatural origins.
No, claiming to be the Messiah wasn't illegal under Jewish law. Having strange cosmic theology wasn't a crime either. He was rejected because he spectacularly failed the one expectation that the vast majority of the desperate, occupied population cared about most.
He didn't fight the Romans.
He didn't fight. The people were starving under taxation. They were occupied. They wanted the warrior from the Psalms of Solomon who would shatter the Romans like pottery.
They wanted an immediate physical military campaign to establish an earthly kingdom right then and there.
And Jesus offered them something entirely different. He offered a kingdom that was not of this world. A kingdom built on spiritual transformation, loving your enemies, and shockingly paying your taxes to Caesar.
Which, for a population living under the boot of a foreign military, an invisible spiritual kingdom probably felt like a better disappointment.
It was the wrong solution to the very immediate, very physical problem they wanted fixed.
Right.
And the tragedy of this era is that their desperate hope for a military conqueror eventually led them to follow violent warlords like Bar Kokhba, which ultimately provoked Rome into utterly destroying Jerusalem and the temple in 70 and 135 AD.
Man, it brings us right back to where we started. This isn't just dry theology or a list of ancient job descriptions. This is a story about extreme trauma.
Yes, absolutely.
It's about human beings crushed by the weight of history, taking a simple ancient ritual, just the smearing of oil on a king and under the pressure cooker of occupation, transforming it into this wild, multi-layered expectation of rescue.
And knowing this history forces you to look past the religious terminology.
Yeah.
When you read these ancient texts, you start to see the very real, very frightened people underneath, just projecting their deepest anxieties onto the heavens, hoping someone, anyone, would come to save them.
It's so easy for us to sit back today and sort of analyze these ancient people waiting for a warrior or a fire-breathing angel. But think about the pressure cooker of our world right now.
Mm-hmm.
If a long-promised deliverer arrived in our world today, what shape would we demand they take based on our own modern anxieties? And if they showed up but didn't fit our exact desperate blueprint, would we even recognize them?